Mediocrity Podcast. Talks about that nerdy stuff. Movies, comics, and video games. It's all good and there ain't no fluff. Brian Kluger is hosting the show. Jeremy Miggert's got jokes. Jonathan Atterbury sounds really handsome, and we all sure love you folks.
And oh my god, it is Mediocrity. I'm so happy to be here. It's going to be an amazing, awesome, and thrilling show. As Jeremy's hat says the letter T on it for thrilling. Oh, Mediocrity, where the show is, it's just okay. We're just okay. We haven't said that in a while. But yeah, we're just an okay show. Mediocre. We're Mediocrity on iTunes, Stitcher Radio. Look for us. Multimedia Men Podcast. We have a crazy, insane show today that's going to be awesome. We are going to be talking about some upcoming Blu-ray releases. That is crazy. New TV shows. New comic books, video games, new movies, as well as two awesome topics of 90s songs and a recast of Pulp Fiction, which might be the hardest thing in the world besides my, you know, little Brian. But I am joined, as always, by the two wild and craziest guys, Jeremy Magert and Jonathan Atterbury. How you fellas doing?
Oh, we're great, man. That intro, I think you said the word crazy about 10 times. So apparently it's going to be a real crazy episode. We're going to get wild talking about 90s songs and shit.
Hi, Jeremy. Are you wild and crazy today?
Oh, yes. I am wild and crazy.
Oh, it's so good. It's so funny. And I have to say, before we started the show, I was trying to test my microphone by just hitting it. And then Atterbury joined in on this call, and I said, like, what's up, man? And he goes, nothing, just doing some fucking karate with a big smile on his face. And I was like, is this true? Is this guy? And like, knowing John, probably yes. But where does he do karate? And like, is it like Johnny Karate from Parks and Rec, or is it like legit shit?
No, it's real karate. I'm studying to get two belts this week, so that's why I've been practicing.
What belts?
Well, so due to the fact that I've only had like a short time to do it, I'm studying for and getting ready to take the my yellow belt test, which is of course the second tier, and then I'm doing the orange belt like literally 10 minutes later. So there's just a lot of stuff that I have to memorize for all of that.
Well, well done. I must say to our audience and to you two, which you may or may not know or may not believe, but I am an actual certified black belt in Taekwondo. Do you guys believe this?
Fuck no, I don't.
We believe that you believe it.
I believe that maybe 9-year-old Brian was a 9-year-old black belt.
No, I got this like I think I got my black belt when I was 13 or 14 years old, maybe 15. But I have it, and next show I will try to remember and bring my belts to you and show them through this video thing, so you can see because they're in storage somewhere. But yes, I definitely went all the way through Taekwondo.
Wow, man, I had no idea that you were a deadly weapon.
I am a deadly weapon.
I think in the next episode, you need to demonstrate some of your moves for us on camera, and we can describe what we're witnessing as Jeremy and I watch it for our audience listening at home.
I'm in.
I think that's a great idea.
That definitely needs to happen.
All right. I'm in.
We're going to need a good 30 minutes for this segment.
Brian does karate. Jeremy and Jonathan describe what they're seeing.
No, it'd be like, you know, ESPN channel where it's like your two are commentators and I'm doing like a floor routine or a pattern and y'all just commentate.
Let's do that. That sounds like a really good idea.
And Jeremy,
and you don't get to hear anything we say until you re-listen to the show later.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Well, just describe what we're seeing, and you won't have the headphones on as you're doing your really awesome black belt shit. And
I might have to buy some boards from Home Depot or some shit to do this.
So, for the Taekwondo, did you have to learn weapons and stuff like that to get your black belt?
Yes, you learned with knives, guns, a bow staff, and nunchucks.
Oh my god, I'm so happy right now.
I feel like
everything we have planned today is now inadequate compared to what we're going to be doing with that topic.
You know what? I would be willing to bet I couldn't make it 45 seconds doing hardcore Taekwondo pattern before I pass out.
Well, Jeremy doesn't live that far from you, so
that's true.
If you do pass out, he'll be over there quickly to resuscitate you.
All right, good. And speaking of Jeremy, I must say, you had a housewarming party recently, and it was lovely and much fun and enjoyable.
Yeah, it was a good time.
It was good. We shared some brews and some whiskeys, a Thelonious Monk brew, which I had to explain to Jeremy who Thelonious Monk was. No?
No.
No. I'm trying to get a rise out of him. It's not working.
The joke was as funny now as it was then.
Oh, it was so good.
I didn't even think you got eyebrow movement out of that one.
I didn't. Right. But no, it was a good time, and I'm glad y'all are enjoying the place because it looks badass. So.
Yeah, it was super fun. Hilariously, all those people were determined to light a fire in the fire pit in my backyard, and fucking 20 minutes after they light a gigantic pile of logs, they all fucking left. So I was like, you know what? There's going to be new rules for the fire pit. And that's it. If you light a fire in my pit, you better be fucking ready to stay there for 9 hours while that shit burns. And that's the new rules that I have set for the deck area.
All right. Well, 9 hours it is. I will stay 9 hours.
And he'll do all of his black belt stuff for you over the span of 9 hours while you sit there and watch.
Oh, so good. All right, let's get to the show in hand. Last week, we talked, Jeremy and I talked about Black Panther. Of course, Atterbury hadn't seen it yet, but he's seen it so far, and I think Jeremy might have seen it maybe 8 times since then. And
I've seen it twice.
Twice, okay, 8, 2, same. And so, opening weekend, the movie Black Panther made over $201 million. Currently, right now, worldwide, it has made $419.5 million. And it has broken records. It has become, like, the biggest box office grossing film in certain categories so far, including the biggest month for biggest movie for February, winter, President's Day, all that stuff, which is cool. So I must say to Jonathan first, I know Jeremy and I really loved it. Did you like it just as much as we did, or do you have problems with it?
Oh, I loved it. I don't think I loved it as much as you, Brian, because you said it's your new favorite Marvel movie of all time. And I wouldn't say it's my favorite of all time, but it's definitely top five. So I really enjoyed it.
Good. And Jeremy, after seeing it a second time, you love it or hate it?
I definitely like it even more. The stuff that I really enjoyed, just enjoyed even more seeing it the second time.
Good. I haven't seen it more than once yet, but I've been dying to see it again. I just haven't yet. Jonathan, did you love how the story was told? Did you get that James Bond aspect, the Lion King aspect, and the Lord of the Rings aspect from it?
You know, I didn't really feel the Lord of the Rings thing. I definitely got the James Bond vibe. That was a very prominent vibe, I think. And then, you know, I think the Lion King thing, to a certain extent, like as soon as the movie started, I was like, oh, it's starting just like the Lion King. Because we've got like the looking up into the stars, the father talking to the son, talking about, you know, what it means to be a king and all that kind of stuff. So I think that was immediately what set the tone. And of course, you know, like the traditional African music and stuff like that. There, unfortunately, there haven't been that many movies where that's been a real setting. I mean, you've got maybe like fucking Coming to America and The Lion King to compare that to.
Yeah.
So it's been like criminally underrepresented in film. And so, of course, we're going to go like, oh, it reminds me of that. But it was just so well done. And the acting was so great. And it, like you said, all of the characters mattered. You know, like when any of the characters were in jeopardy, it was actually like scary. You're like, oh, I don't want anything to happen to that character because that character actually has depth to them. And they're not just a throwaway, you know, useless character.
Yeah, they were so fleshed out. And I have to say, like, Killmonger, that character, the villain played by Michael B. Jordan, like, just the whole time I was like, dude, this dude's right. Like, this dude is, like, I legit believe him. And, like, the rest, like, T'Challa and, like, everybody else, I'm like, dude, they really fucked up.
Yeah, you know, I loved that they had a villain with, you know, that was in that gray zone. And some real depth to him and made it more realistic, because so rare in real life are there evil people that are just truly evil just for the fucking sake of being evil. And everything they do is evil. And there's no, you know, other side to the story. You don't hardly ever see that. So I love to see it when you get these characters that actually you can relate to parts of what they're doing and parts of what their thought process is. That makes it so much more realistic. And I love that.
Did you like the action sequences?
The action sequences were great. I think the only thing that bothered me a little bit at any point was some of the lines that they gave to Killmonger.
Okay.
I actually really liked Michael B. Jordan's acting, but there were just a few lines that they gave him that were a little cringy. But for the most part, it was great. And I got to say, Chadwick Boseman is fucking awesome.
I really think he played like a James Bond type of personality, like the calm, cool,
kind of, but
deadly.
Dude, they did such a good job of nailing what royalty ought to feel like.
Yeah.
With him, you know, like he seemed kingly, but in a way that you can respect, and like the really admirable kind of king, not the kind of, you know, royalty that we've seen in other films and stuff like that. But just like, you're like, that guy's fucking awesome.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. So he really nailed it. Kind of like just sort of like quiet, assertive leadership. I mean, I think in that whole movie, he only yelled, like raised his voice one time. And that's when he wanted to know. I forget the guy who the guy that Forrest Whitaker played, when he wanted to know the story behind that. That was the only time I actually remember him getting angry in the entire movie and actually yelling at someone.
Right.
And I thought that was a really nice touch for them to approach the character like that, where he's, you know, very calm, collected, you know, still assertive, but is able to be assertive without being boisterous.
Yeah, I loved that. That was fantastic. You know, just real poise and dignity to that character, and that was really cool. And I also got to say, the clothes in that movie were so cool. I mean, like, I was watching that the whole time, and I was like, man, I really wish I could get away with wearing stuff like that without looking like a total idiot.
You know, so, you want to do that. I know. You just said you did. You want to.
I want to, but I would look like an asshole. I can't do it. It's not something that's within the realm of something that white people should be doing. I don't think wearing dashikis and stuff like that, I don't think we're allowed to do that.
Why not? It's part of it. That's, anybody can wear that.
I think I'm pretty sure that you'd immediately look like an asshole.
If you like it, you like it. As long as
it's awesome and it looks cool as hell, but I just don't think I can pull it off.
I would love to see it. Any other lasting remarks on Black Panther?
I really dug a lot of the design. It kind of goes along with what John was saying, but like the world building that they did for Wakanda, the thing I really dug about it was like its own completely created world on Earth. Typically, everything we see on Earth in the Marvel movies, and really, I mean, any superhero movie, it's like you see New York and you see L.A. or San Francisco, whatever, and, you know, Spider-Man swinging over the New York skyline. The only time we really got to see completely new environments was in movies like Thor and Guardians of the Galaxy. And the thing I dug about Wakanda was they were basically able to sort of create this environment from scratch and have it be on Earth.
Yeah. All right.
And you guys were also right that the score and soundtrack was awesome. I really enjoyed the score and soundtrack for that movie.
Yeah, it was damn good. I really liked it. I want to see it again, and I can't wait to. And I'm glad, Jeremy, you loved it even more the second time, which I'll probably do the same. And Atterbury, I'm sorry you enjoyed it. Nobody laughs at my jokes. What's going on?
Well, we laugh at the funny ones.
It's your jokes.
Oh, well, damn it. I need to work on them.
So there's a theory that in the vibranium mountain that crashed on Earth, there's an infinity stone.
On Earth, huh?
Yes.
Well, it's not Wakanda, though, is it? Or is it?
What?
Well, yeah.
Okay,
you saw the movie, right?
Right.
That's where the giant vibranium asteroid crashed.
Okay. So if the Infinity Stone is there, I guess that sets up the whole thing for Avengers Infinity?
Well, that's why, like, you see Cap in Wakanda fighting, and there's, like, an army of what I'm assuming is Chitauri rushing towards them, and they're running towards the army with, like, the Hulk and shit.
Okay. No,
Black Widow?
Yeah.
Because that could... Because what people are speculating is it's actually the soul gem, and that's most likely what's causing the heart-shaped plants to grow out of the earth, which then bestow the panther powers.
Yeah. All right.
That's a cool theory.
Yeah.
makes sense.
Yeah. I like that one.
Cool. I'm in. I guess we don't have to wait a year. We only have to wait, like, 2 months to see that.
I mean, I don't know if that theory is as credible as Snoke is Mace Windu.
Yes.
But it's a theory.
The jury's still out on that.
Martin Freeman has been Lando Calrissian the whole time.
That's why he can fly a ship.
Well,
because he's also a pilot.
Speaking of Lando Calrissian, a little bit of Blu-ray 4K news was announced today. Star Wars The Last Jedi has been announced. Coming to 4K Ultra HD and Blu-ray. They are both going to be in Dolby Vision. Fantastic. Disney's first Dolby Vision with HDR10 and Dolby Atmos. And then a plethora of supplements, bonus features, including 14 never-before-seen deleted scenes, which I'm very excited. All 14 deleted scenes will have an introduction and optional commentary by writer-director Rian Johnson. In addition to that, there will be an audio commentary with Rian Johnson as well. And then there is Andy Serkis Live, One Night Only, where Rian Johnson presents two exclusive sequences from the movie featuring Andy Serkis, a raw on-set performance from his digital makeover as Snoke, which is going to be awesome to see actually Andy Serkis do entire scenes as himself and not with the CG stuff. Very exciting. Also, scene breakdowns. Some of the big scenes are going to be shown how they did them. Also, Balance of the Force. They're going to explore the mythology of the Force and why Rian Johnson chose to interpret the Force in his unique way, like we saw in the film. And then also more stuff with Rian Johnson on his journey into making the film. So I'm very excited about this. What do you guys think?
That was a lot of details about the yes. Blu-ray.
Yeah.
That well, was like a lot.
No,
you well, actually like... made Jeremy yawn. I watched it.
On this show, Brian Kluger will read the back of a Blu-ray box.
Yeah, but no, this. I wish I had this right now, but no. This just came out. This news is brand new, and so people are going to be excited to hear all the cool stuff that's going to be on here. And plus, Dolby Vision's an excellent thing as well as Dolby Atmos. This is awesome for Disney and for Star Wars. So, very excited about this. Are you guys not?
I'm excited that the movie is coming out on Blu-ray.
Okay.
I don't even remember when you said it was coming out.
I haven't said that yet.
Okay.
But
see, that's the only important part.
That to me is the most important detail of all of that shit.
Basically,
when do I get it?
A month from now. Digitally, you can get it March 13th, and then you'll be able to pick it up on Blu-ray or 4K on March 27th. But you could watch it as early as March 13th, which is only a couple weeks away, really.
in like 1 week after Thor, I think.
Yes, and speaking of Thor Ragnarok, I just got the 4K in, so that's happening tonight.
I was really worried that you're about to read us the back of that package, too.
You can go get it if you want.
I will go get it. Hold on. No.
We'll just talk
about Thor Ragnarok is 200 minutes long.
No,
there is closed captioning.
But let's talk about this for a second. It doesn't say how long.
I will now read you the list of extras from the movie.
Everybody likes bonus features, especially for like Star Wars The Last Jedi. And speaking of those deleted scenes, 14 never-before-seen deleted scenes. What deleted scenes do you think they will add here? Because the movie's already 2.5 hours long. This might make it a 3-hour movie.
I doubt it. I bet it'll make it 2 hours and 35 minutes long. It's probably like in every other Star Wars film that I've seen the extras for, it's always like a 20-second clip or a 30-second clip of crap, and you go, yeah, that's why they cut that out, because it doesn't work.
Yeah, it's always stuff small. Like in Revenge of the Sith, there was like a deleted scene of like a different way that they took to fucking get to the Chancellor before they, you know, fought Count Dooku.
So an alternate, you know, yeah.
Okay. I've so never seen
little stuff like that,
except for some of the deleted stuff in A New Hope, like where you actually see Luke talking to Biggs before leaving Tatooine, which I thought was cool. In all the other movies, there's really nothing that you go, oh, that like that should have been in there. Why didn't they? You know, that was a really important scene. Usually, it's just total fluff.
So you don't think that this is? You think this is going to be the same thing? You don't think there's going to be any like really cool scenes that they like left out for some reason?
Well, I didn't see anything interesting in the deleted scenes for the last movie, Force Awakens. Not one thing worth watching.
Okay.
Same thing with Rogue One.
Okay. All right. We'll see. We'll see.
I'm not trying to sound like a party pooper. I'm just saying that I'm not that excited about the deleted scenes because I always watch them and I'm like, oh, okay.
I mean, weren't you the ones that said that Hayden Christensen came on the set of this movie and did a scene, but they didn't end up?
That's not going to be in the deleted scenes.
That's a deleted scene. That would
Bullshit.
Be a deleted scene.
No. If they're actually putting Anakin Skywalker in one of these movies, it's not going to be on the cutting room floor.
Hmm. I don't know.
I think that I was the one that had talked about that and that I heard that he had showed up and that it was an alternate to the Yoda scene. But from what J.J. Abrams has said is the third movie is going to tie together all 9 Star Wars movies. So it very well could be that he will end up being in that movie.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, hopefully we all look forward to Star Wars The Last Jedi. Moving on, a little bit of a new TV show coming out on Amazon Prime starting March 30th. This is going to be a single camera comedy series called The Dangerous Book for Boys. And it is made by the guy who made Superbad and the Breaking Bad star himself, Walter White, Bryan Cranston, which centers on a family whose father dies and who this father was an inventor of all these crazy things. And I guess his kids find his book of inventions and like how to make other things. And they do that. It's going to be a new TV series. And I think with the director of Superbad and Bryan Cranston behind it, that sounds damn fun. What do you
think? It does sound interesting.
So yeah, it's called The Dangerous.
I will be checking that out.
Yeah. It's called The Dangerous Book for Boys. And
is it a comedy?
Yeah, it's a single camera comedy series, so I think it's going to be, you know, I might go over into like the dramatic side a little bit, but yeah, comedy, definitely.
See, I thought you said it was comedy. It's a comedy, and it's like about this family where the dad dies, and I was like, well, that doesn't sound funny.
But all Disney movies have like people dying in them.
Most Disney movies are not comedies, though.
True, but I'm looking forward to this. It sounds like it'll be fun, and let's hope. It works out. Moving on to the comic book world. Judge Dredd is coming back to comic book stores with a new brand new series beginning with a 4-part storyline called Under Siege, which will be written by Mark Russell, who did some Flintstone stuff. Jeremy, are you excited about this?
Yeah, I'll probably check it out. I haven't really read much Judge Dredd comics. I mean, I wasn't aware he was actually out of comics. I thought they were always making Judge Dredd.
Okay. Well, I guess this is like the relaunch of IDW Publishing's Judge Dredd series. So this is like, I guess, a big deal. But I guess it's going to take place in one of like the more violent blocks of the city. So... of the mega city. So I'm looking forward to it. I mean, it's unfortunate that I doubt we're going to get another sequel to that great remake we saw a few years ago. But I guess in comic book form, if you're a Judge Dredd fan, you'll be able to get this.
So is the TV show still on?
I didn't know Judge Dredd had a TV show.
Yeah, man. It's called like Mega City One. It's supposed to cover like, I think it's in production right now. And basically, instead of it being Judge Dredd, it's just going to kind of cover, like, Mega City and a bunch of other judges.
All right.
And supposedly the dude that's producing it is good friends with Carl Urban, so you will probably get Carl Urban Dredd, like, appearing at some point in it.
Okay.
Maybe, like, beginning and end type of shit.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Thought that was pretty interesting. A little factoid, we've talked about Bill and Ted before, as in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Yes, Bill and Ted are making their third movie with Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter, the originals, along with the original writer of the film. It is called Bill and Ted Face the Music, and it is announced that they are bringing back Will Sadler's Death character into the third movie, which, if you saw Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, he was a fantastic and hilarious character, where Bill and Ted actually played him in Battleship, Clue, and Electronic Football in the Game of Death. Are y'all excited about this?
I have never seen any of the Bill and Ted movies.
Oh, man, you need to watch those. They're so good.
I kind of believe you.
Jeremy, don't like them?
They're dated, but they're good.
Oh, man. For a young little chap like yourself, Jonathan, growing up in California, this speaks to you. Playing music and shit? What are you talking about?
I don't know. I've just never got around to watching them.
All right. All right, so there's that. I'm very excited about that. Bill and Ted Face the Music hopefully will start filming shortly, but I'm very excited. Our last bit of news before we get to our two main topics is a very interesting one. We're going to have a good conversation about it because I want your thoughts on what's happening in the toy world. We all know who Hasbro is, right?
Yes.
Hasbro Toys, they make, like, everything. Marvel, Transformers, G.I. Joe, and Star Wars. Well, Hasbro also is the biggest toy company in the world. They make billions of dollars. But now, they are going to crowdfunding. Interestingly enough, they are starting to crowdfund new toys for people. And we'll get to that in a second. But I guess they're reason behind this is that I guess they hear a lot from, you know, the consumers, and they want certain toys. So they're checking, they're starting this like side company called HasLab, not Hasbro, HasLab. And basically it will be kind of like Kickstarter, Indiegogo, where they will release toys, and if they get enough money, they will send them to you if you donate the money. So basically, their first limited edition toy they're doing, if the goal is met, is a 4-foot toy of Jabba's sail barge from Return of the Jedi. It's going to weigh 14 pounds. And over a foot wide and nearly a foot and a half tall. It's going to cost $500, and there has to be at least 5,000 people ordering it for it to go. With that in mind, do you think this is a good avenue to go down? Are you into this? Do you want this first thing, or what?
I think that the whole notion is almost offensive as a consumer, And I think that the fact that they want to launch a fucking 4-foot sail barge is a really obscure, weird choice. I mean, I think that probably it'll sell, but it just, like, I don't fucking want a 4-foot sail barge. I mean, I can think of a million other Star Wars toys I'd rather have than a sail barge that's that large.
Yeah, so, but think about this. You're going to move into the woods and you don't have a gym. Just get this fucking thing and run around outdoors with it.
Just lift it
over.
Put
it over your head and fucking run around the woods.
So this first thing, this Jabba sail barge, is designed to be to look like the old vintage collection. It could also be displayed as the full sail barge. You can remove the side panels to show off all the figures you can fit inside of it. It will have the soft cloth sails. I mean, it comes with Jabba the Hutt. But yeah, it's like 4 feet long, weighs 14 pounds. And
that's too much money.
And it's 400.
$500 is crazy.
Well, so, okay, you say that, but like Lego,
Yeah, that shit is crazy too.
Yeah,
that's why I haven't bought any of that
Lego
stuff.
Lego Millennium Falcon, $750, and that's also fucking dumb.
That's dumb.
And I love offensive. Lego, and that's fucking dumb.
Hey, you want to buy this box of plastic for $700?
Oh yeah, no,
go fuck yourselves, Lego.
It's insane. Yeah. It's insane. But what do you think about that? Like, I want to know, like, if there was legit something cool that they would release, would you be into this? Or do you think, like, why don't they just release it?
Here's why this is complete fucking bullshit on Hasbro's part. You have a company that is probably worth billions of dollars, and they're going to crowdfund something that they don't want to pay for themselves. Now,
Yes. You
don't have to crowdfund it. You could just say, hey, we're going to take pre-orders, and if we get enough pre-orders, we'll ship them out. But what they're basically doing is this big company has looked at the crowdfunding and the Kickstarter and all of the money that's in there, and they're basically trying to cut in to all of the, like, independent Kickstarter crowdfunding money, and that's what it is. It's basically a shitty cash grab from a billion-dollar company.
Yeah, I agree. I think that Kickstarter and stuff like that needs to be for independents that can't afford to do the kind of stuff that a billion-dollar industry corporation can do. And the fact that they're trying to get into that space is a total dick move.
And look what they're making. They're making a fucking 5-foot sail barge for, honestly, for people that have a giant fucking game room and huge amounts of space. And honestly, to where that amount of money is just disposable income. It's a really crap move by Hasbro.
Well, so on the other hand, I don't know if I feel as strongly about that as that, but I mean, there are fans out there and they're limited to 5,000. 5,000 people out of like a billion people basically of Star Wars fans. It's a very small number, even if 5 million. But
well, so here's the thing. If Hasbro actually thinks that there's a market for it, then they need to take a chance just like every other toy developer and make a limited amount of them. They can say, "Hey, it's a collector's item because there's only 5,000 of them," and they're going to charge what they're going to charge and take a chance. If it doesn't sell, sorry, come up with a better fucking toy idea.
I have no problem that they're doing it. I have a problem that they're going to like Kickstarter and that kind of thing, that they're intentionally going after Kickstarter money.
Well, I don't know if it's going after Kickstarter. I guess from their business standpoint, they know that
by Kickstarter, I just mean crowdfunding. You're going after independent crowdfunding money from a billion-dollar company.
Okay. So yeah, there is that. But then, you know, not a lot of people are making like these toys that certain fans definitely have wanted and asked for. And I guess with Hasbro, of course, they're not going to make their money back if they do it the other way, because they're probably not going to make this expensive toy.
What does that have to do with a billion-dollar company cash grab and independent money?
Because I think this way they can guarantee to get their money back and the fans get what they want.
But they can do that with pre-orders. They can just say, here, click on it, and we'll send you some.
And that's basically,
well, on top
I guess,
of that,
what
there are
is.
So few industries that get a guaranteed return on their investments. When does that happen with anything?
Like, why are they entitled to the guaranteed return on a fucking 5-foot plastic sail barge?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Like, if you want to make sure you get your fucking money back, then come up with the most badass toy that everyone is going to want. And then guess what? Release it at Christmas time, and you'll probably get your money back if it's something that people want that bad.
This is probably one of the biggest thing, they probably did their research, and like, this is probably the most requested thing that people have wanted.
Then why is it such a gamble?
Who knows?
That they need to invest or independent money.
Because I guess they don't want to spend the money on it yet and have it be a flop.
That's the thing, is they don't want to spend the money on it. They're like, sorry, we're only concerned about the bottom line, so we'll spend your money at first.
Well, the billion-dollar companies going after using Kickstarter and that shit, it's just crap. It's super douchey.
Well, if you want to take a look at it, you can go to the HasLab site, H-A-S-L-A-B, and you can check out everything about this Jabba sail barge and look in to see what they're doing. I'm going to look at it actually right now, and I can tell you, right now there are 1,461 people out of 5,000 backers, and they have 42 days to go, and it is $499 plus tax. So there's not even halfway done yet, but they just announced it today. So I don't know. It's you'll be able to see like what it looks like and all the stuff you'll be able to do with it. But yeah, it is. It's an interesting thing what they're doing. And I guess if this doesn't work, who knows what they're going to do? But yeah, HasbroLab.com. Is there anything that you would want that has not come out yet from a Star Wars universe that you would be down for this?
There is nothing that I would pay Hasbro for in a Kickstarter way. Okay. I could see if there was a actual like, an independent toy manufacturer that made fantastic quality stuff, hand painted shit that you can't get that's actual art and collector's items. Then yes, I could imagine doing a Kickstarter type thing for that, but not for a company like Hasbro who doesn't even make that high quality stuff anyways.
Okay. No, I mean, it's expensive.
And,
it's a big,
and it's weird to me that they went with the sail barge. It's like, you're going to do a 4-foot like gigantic toy. Give me like I'd rather like a 4-foot AT-AT makes more sense than Jabba's sail barge. You know, like maybe a 4-foot AT-AT. Or a giant fucking Death Star that comes with cable supports to hang from your ceiling.
I'm interested to see where this goes. And yeah, again, like you said, this is probably a Christmas thing. It's not Christmas anytime soon. But like most people want to spend like $20-$30 and get like two or three toys for that, and not $500 and get one gigantic piece that's going to. It literally,
I don't see that being a big Christmas killer. That's for nerds that are buying it for themselves.
And they're buying it. And there's a lot of like hardcore, like the Star Wars collector market is decent size enough that like the guys that like the dude that runs Rancho Obi-Wan, he's probably going to buy two of these. You know, it's like he'll have one on display when you go in there, and a lot of the other dudes like him will buy one.
Yeah. No, I have some friends that will possibly buy this. They're just Star Wars fans who have, you know, some extra money to go around. But again, yeah, it's a weird thing to crowdfund. And I guess from their business thing, like, you know, it's an open market, I guess. And I guess they can do what they want. I mean, it's kind of weird that they wouldn't. Yeah, like you said, they just wouldn't do pre-orders. But I guess this is kind of like a pre-order. But instead of like pre-ordering, let's say 20 or 30 of them before it comes out, they have to do 5,000 for it to make it work. So I guess that's kind of the deal. So I don't know.
Well, I mean, you could still do pre-orders and say, we got to have 5,000 pre-orders.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. It's weird.
I think it's just tasteless. That's what I think.
Yeah,
I
agree.
That's the best way to sum it up.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. Tasteless Hasbro, HasLab, HasbroLab.com. Check it out if you want to, and let us know if you buy it. We won't judge you at all. All right. to our two topics, what are we going to do first, Jonathan?
Well, I don't know, but first, before we get into that, I got to say that I have been having so much fun playing Call of Duty World War II with you lately, Brian.
Oh, my goodness. I have had So interestingly enough, you know, I've been playing Battlefront 2 forever, and you know, rarely getting on Player Unknown or Overwatch, rarely if at all, but just Battlefront. And then all of a sudden, Jonathan's like, "Get on Call of Duty World War 2." I'm like, "All right, I'm gonna be terrible at this." And what happened?
You got on and you were great at it.
I surprised myself.
Just so our listeners know, Brian has a reputation in video games, and it's not a reputation for being the strongest player on the team. However, in Call of Duty, he seems to be a bit of a savant with the flaming shotgun in that game. He is really good at setting people on fire in that game.
It is so much fun, and it's such a welcome, easy-to-play, perfect fluid motion, no problems.
When you say easy to play, you mean that it works correctly, not that it's a simple, easy game.
Correct. Yeah, right. Yeah, it's like issue-free game that we experience a lot on Battlefront 2 and other games. But
that's what's so nice about it. It's just really refreshing to play a game that just fucking works. And it sounds so silly to say that, but it's becoming increasingly rare that you play a game that's even a AAA title that just, especially a multiplayer game, that actually works the way it's intended to without that having like maddeningly present defaults.
But yeah, we've been having so much fun playing this, and I've been enjoying it so much, and to hear the screams when somebody's set on fire, and I must say, Mr. Atterbury himself is damn good with the sniper rifle, because more than one occasion, he has killed two people at the same time with one bullet.
Well, last night I actually had my best streak so far. Okay. There were two games in a row we played, and I died a combined two times in both of those matches.
Yep, he died.
And I got like 20 kills per match or something like that.
Yes, he was doing so well. But yeah.
It's just a lot of fun. We've been having a great time doing it, and it works well. And they have a really cool kind of collection system. So you can – it's all cosmetic stuff. Which works for me. It's kind of loot boxes, but it's cosmetic only, so that doesn't bother me. But it's just a lot of fun. We've had a great time doing it. The pace is really fast, so there's not a lot of a lot of other shooters. You kind of run, die, and then you respawn, and you have to run just to die again, and that gets old fast. But this is much more fast paced than that.
Yes, I agree. It's been great, and I always look forward to playing. And I look back like on Battlefront 2, and I'm like, I miss Battlefront 2, but man, like the ease of this game right now, not like the ease of gameplay, but like just how well it works, and like you're only waiting like 10 seconds to start a match, and it's just
And it's also nice because when playing Battlefront 2, there's something that's you kind of know you're playing against kids because or playing on the same team with a bunch of kids, because it is a game. It's a shooter that's made for people of all ages. And it's really obvious that there are all ages playing that when you've got just a team of people that have no idea anything about strategy or tactics. So that's one of the most frustrating things about Battlefront, is I love so much about that game. But it does get frustrating when you're playing with people that just have no idea how to play a first-person shooter. And so that's kind of the nice thing about Call of Duty World War II, is there's a more serious tier of player in that game, and that makes it a little bit more challenging.
Perfect. Yeah, it's – I don't know what it is. It was a nice welcome from playing Battlefront 2 for months now.
Definitely. It's been a lot of fun. And we wish that Jeremy would join us, but we know he won't.
That is correct.
Jeremy is prejudiced against Call of Duty.
Hey, I mean, you can like a bunch of reskinned video games. It's all good.
Well, Battlefront 2 is just a reskin of Battlefront 1.
It is. It's a little more than that, and you know it.
That I know. But this is different, not just a reskin. I mean, I think the thing that I didn't like was like Call of Duty Black Ops and all those Modern Warfare games. Those were just like the same thing over and over when it was Black Ops 1, Black Ops 2, yada, yada, yada. That definitely got on my nerves. And I think we only played one of those when they first came out, Jeremy. And that got old pretty fast. But this one's got a definitely different feel. So I forgive it.
No, it's been great. It's been fun. And then I guess today, speaking of Battlefront 2, I guess the new patch came out today with the new...
Came out yesterday, on Monday.
So jetpacks... And it said jetpack only for a limited time, so it's not going to be a full-time game mode.
So there's the new patch 1.2 that came out for Battlefront 2. It's got the new game mode, jetpack cargo, and it's got... They added a bunch of maps to arcade mode. And they also did a bunch of hero balancing tweaks. So it should feel somewhat different. Oh, they also changed they increased the brightness of the lightsabers and the blaster bolts. So that's kind of a little thing, but I thought that was cool. It makes it more reflective on the various surfaces. So that's kind of neat.
That's good. Jeremy, did you play it yet?
I played a little bit of it. I read all the tweaking they did to the heroes, and everything they did actually sounded pretty good. And they actually added hero skins to Han, Luke, and Leia. They have Hoth versions of each one to unlock.
Hmm. All right.
So definitely some new stuff to check out. I'm hoping that it fixes some of the problems that we were running into.
All right. I'm very interested to play that again, but it's going to be hard to go back to it because World War II has been so much fun.
It has been.
Yes. All right. Two topics that we have for this week. The recast of Pulp Fiction, which is very difficult to do, and 90s songs. The best 90s songs. 90s songs that defined that decade. What are they?
Yeah, to me, the category, it wasn't necessarily the best 90s songs as much as it was the ones that felt the most definitively 90s.
Well, to each
of us, exactly. To whoever, and that, I think that I wanted to hear this from you guys because hearing what represents 90s songs most in our own minds is going to tell us a lot about where we were, how old we were, what kind of scene we were involved in, all that kind of stuff. It's interesting.
All right. Well, this is your topic, man. Who you want to go first?
You want me to go first?
No, this is who do you want to go first?
Oh, I want Jeremy to go first.
All right.
Because Jeremy was like 40 in 1990, so he's going to have a very different perspective than us.
He is.
Well, this was a weird topic for me because, like, when I was in high school, when a lot of the 90s music was popular, like, I was playing guitar, but that was kind of the point when, I was really getting, like, discovering, deeper into blues music and, like, a little bit of jazz. And so, like, I was really finding things like B.B. King and Eric Clapton. And so, like, for the most part of what people consider 90s music never really resonated with me. The only thing that really resonated for me personally was some like the Counting Crows stuff.
Okay.
And so, I mean, honestly, like outside of the Counting Crows, there's really nothing 90s music wise, that I enjoyed with any longevity. I mean, like I can listen to every now and then, like if Stone Temple Pilots comes on, but I'm never going to go put on Stone Temple Pilots. I'm never going to really go put on, Soundgarden, I enjoyed some Pearl Jam, Nirvana was one thing that a lot of people were into that I never got, like, just intensely never got. So
but you like, did you like the 90s Clapton stuff, being a big Clapton fan, like My Father's Eyes, Tears in Heaven, stuff like that, or the 90s Unplugged Layla?
And when he did, when he did that and when he did From the Cradle, that was another big thing for me. A lot of the B.B. King stuff I discovered was in the 90s, like when I first heard the album Why I Sing the Blues. That was a huge, huge album for me that really was something that I loved. But, yeah, so it's a little weird because a lot of, like, when you think of, like, staples of 90s music, like, I remember when I was in high school, like, there were three things that everybody was listening to, and that was Jane's Addiction, Nirvana, and Pantera. And those were three things that I just, were always on and always around me, but I never cared for.
Well, I know you're a humongous Counting Crows fan, mm-hmm. and that stuff is pretty heavily 90s. So, like, a song like A Long December, for example, or Mr. Jones, or Around Here, those were all really popular 90s songs.
Yeah.
then really nailed that 90s vibe.
I think part of, though, for me, like when I think of 90s music, I think less of the Counting Crows. And, and if somebody was to say what is a little bit more indicative of that era, like I always think a little bit more of like the Seattle-based stuff, you know, like Alice in Chains and, you know, Pearl Jam and Nirvana and a lot of the bands coming out. Like, to me, that's the most whenever somebody just says 90s music, that's actually the thing that kind of comes to mind for me more so than the bands like Counting Crows and some of the little bit more like singer songwritery type of bands.
Very fair.
Cool.
All right, Kluger, how about you? What are the songs that are the most 90s to you that immediately take you back to the 90s?
Okay, I overcompensated for myself, and I did 10 songs, so I'm going to list them out right here.
You're only supposed to do 5, and Kluger did 10. So.
I did 10, because I love this. Right. This was cool, because all these songs define me. From 1992, Whitney Houston's I Will Always Love You. God damn, that song's amazing. I still listen to it. 1991's Smells Like Teen Spirit from Nirvana.
Did you do one for each year?
No, I did not.
Okay.
Smells Like Teen Spirit. 1992's Jump, Jump, Crisscross Make You Jump, Jump. I listen to that shit all the time. I had some backwards pants.
All right, so 1992, how old were you, Brian?
I was 11.
So you were like at a really good age for that music.
Yes.
Right on.
Also 1992's Ain't Nothing But a G Thing by Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg. It's like this and like that and like this, Anna. Holy shit. I was young, but I love that song. I had some African-American neighbors who we listened to that. They introduced me to it, and I love it. 1995's Isn't It Ironic by Alanis Morissette. I love that whole album. But yes, Ironic, I loved. 1996's Killing Me Softly remake by the Fugees. Fantastic. So good. 1992's Holy Shit, My Anthem, Baby Got Back by Sir Mix-a-Lot. Oh, Seattle.
It is hard. Okay, you've nailed a few strong, like, songs that to me are very strong 90s songs. It's hard to do that without talking about Baby Got Back.
Yeah, Baby Got... Oh, holy shit. That changed my life. also, another song that changed my life that came out in 1990, which was the start of a phenomenon. You Can't Touch This by MC Hammer. Hammer Pants, Dancing. Oh, my God.
See, to me, like, I don't even... Like, that feels more like an 80s song because it was so barely the 90s at that point.
That was the start of the 90s. That was like...
I know. I mean, it definitely counts. But I'm just saying for my own feel, like, there were some songs that I was like, that's totally a 90s song. And then I was like, but it doesn't really feel like a 90s song. But go on, please.
All right. Last two, 1993's Creep by Radiohead. And 1991... Enter Sandman by Metallica. Oh man, that song got a lot of play. That was like hard rock, like
wow, that was really something.
So what do you think?
That was like Creed doing Metallica.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Not sorry. But yeah, I think those really, you know, I didn't put any Michael Jackson on there, which I could.
Surprise, man. I was expecting Black and White or.
Yeah, I was expecting Black and White too.
No, none of that. I didn't even put like Warren G's Regulators on there or anything. I didn't do that. These were the songs for me.
Very interesting. That's a good list. I like it.
Okay, good.
So for my list, I'm just going to say the ones that these are not necessarily my favorite 90s songs, but it's the ones that immediately transport me to that time period. And I feel like I'm in the 90s when I hear these songs. Number one, in no particular order, No Diggity by Blackstreet.
No diggity, you got to play it all. I like the way you work it.
Brian's going to be doing renditions of all of these songs, apparently. I like it. Keep doing that, please. Next up, one of my favorite 90s songs, Two Princes by the Spin Doctors. I can't hear that song without being immediately taken back to the 90s, man. It's like that was one of those songs that really captured the 90s in my brain.
Are the Spin Doctors still, like, alive?
Oh, I'm sure they're coming to a county fair near you.
I don't even know about that, man. Maybe just a bar near you. Because that song, that's a great song. And so is their other one, Little Miss Can't Be Wrong. Those are great songs. Next up, this one is so heavy. It's like, this was the first song that came to my mind when I thought of, like, serious 90s songs. And it's Dreams by the Cranberries.
Yeah, the Cranberries.
That song is so, so 90s. I can't think of anything more 90s than that song. Can you think of, do you know this song I'm talking about, Brian?
I do not.
I was waiting for you to try to sing it.
No, I do not know that. I know the Cardigans, not the Cranberries. Same band.
Well, they're next up on my list.
Oh, fantastic.
Love Fool by the Cardigans.
I can't believe that happened. Same band.
That's another great 90s song, and I actually really like that song. I remember loving that when I was a kid, and to this day, I listen to it, I'm like, this is still a cool song. So definitely a cool one. And last but not least, this is a little bit outside of the box, but not really. It's a song by the Rembrandts called I'll Be There For You.
I'll be there for you. Says
the theme from Friends, my personal favorite show of all time.
You're fucking terrible. And,
I think that it's hard that that's a pretty 90s song.
You're a 90s song.
Well, yeah, that's my list.
I liked your list up until the last one. You had to bring Friends into it. We were having a good time, and then you just shit over everything.
I didn't say that you had to like the songs. I said they were the most representative of them.
I want to go back into, like, we said Jeremy was 40 years old when 1990s, and his music selection definitely told us that.
I was listening to B.B. King in the 90s.
That was good.
All the young kids were listening to Nirvana. I just didn't get it. Sounded like a bunch of noise to me.
And it still does.
Oh, that was good. That was good. But yeah, 90s songs. Let us know what 90s songs you are into. I mean, there's so many to choose from.
I had to cull the list so many times because it just kept growing, and it was hard. It was like choosing your favorite pet or something. But you know, we got there.
Well, all right. Our last segment. The Pulp Fiction recast, which is very, very difficult. Pulp Fiction, probably one of the best movies ever made, ever written. Best characters. I mean, this is just, and then it's so iconic that it's very difficult to picture somebody who's not in the original Pulp Fiction, in the actor that's not in that role. Like, it's very difficult. But we did it anyway.
Dude, this was a challenge because, like you just said, it's so hard to think of anyone playing those roles except for the people that did it, because it was just so very unique and hitting the nail on the head that it was really hard to try to recast this. But I'm interested. I've been looking forward all week to hearing what you guys had for this.
All right. I'm going to go first, all right?
All right. Do it.
All right. So I'm going to start with Vincent Vega and Jules, you know, the John Travolta, Samuel Jackson characters. And because we're going to recast the director here too, but like Tarantino has done in many of his movies, he's taken actors that haven't done much in a while and has made them relevant again. He did that with Travolta in Pulp Fiction. So I'm doing the same thing with Vincent Vega and Jules Winfield. Instead of Travolta and Samuel Jackson playing these two characters, I'm going to have Adam Sandler as Vincent Vega and Eddie Murphy as Jules Winfield. These guys need a resurgence in their careers, and I think with the director I picked out, it'll be able to happen. And plus, to see Adam Sandler play Vincent Vega in this way, because, like, as we've seen in, like, Punch Drunk Love, he is awesome when he can be...
That's a $5 shake. Would you do it?
I was imagining the exact same thing.
No, no. Have y'all seen Punch Drunk Love? I mean, he is amazing in that movie.
And Eddie, all right.
And Eddie Murphy as Jules will be awesome as well. I think that could
now work. I want to know, because you said it makes sense when you hear who's casting, who's directing it. And I just get like, I'm trying to imagine who could direct that
maybe
movie.
Maybe we need
and make
to
it
start
work.
With the director and then go from there.
Let's do that, because that's going to help us understand what your creative vision is for this movie. And then we'll get into the casting.
Okay. My director I've picked to remake Pulp Fiction is none other than the auteur and driver behind such films as Hot Fuzz, Shaun of the Dead, and Baby Driver, Edgar Wright. Edgar Wright remaking Pulp Fiction with Adam Sandler and Eddie Murphy. Going with the character of Butch, played by Bruce Willis. I just picked the Bruce Willis Part 2, Jason Statham. That's what I did.
I knew that was going to happen.
Marcellus Wallace, originally played by Ving Rhames. I'm just going Denzel Washington because I just want to see Denzel Washington play this role. Mia Wallace, who originally played Uma Thurman and Marcellus Wallace's wife. I think Scarlett Johansson would be perfect for that.
Interesting choice.
Lance, played by Eric Stoltz in the original, the drug dealer, the redhead drug dealer. I went with Seth Rogen because I think it would be great to see him, just Seth Rogen, run around with Adam Sandler and stab her in the heart. You got to stab her three times. I got to stab her three times. No. Okay.
I almost chose him. I almost picked Seth Rogen, but I thought better. But I like that. I do like that idea.
And then the wolf, originally played by Harvey Keitel, who's wearing a tuxedo at like 6-7 in the morning, comes over and handles things. I picked Sir Patrick Stewart because I want to see him handle his business in that manner so badly.
Very interesting choice.
So
Stewart.
I could go on, but those are the only characters I recasted right now. But with Edgar Wright at the helm, because I think Edgar Wright does very well with great editing techniques, writing his characters, and incorporating music into everything. So if Pulp Fiction had to be redone, this is what I'd want to see. Mostly because I want to see Adam Sandler and Eddie Murphy do something amazing again.
I'm sorry. I can't wrap my brain around Adam Sandler. I could buy Eddie Murphy, I think, as Jules, but I cannot buy Vincent or Adam Sandler as Vincent.
Have you seen John Travolta do Vincent Vega? And have you seen Adam Sandler in Punch Drunk Love? It's just kind of like, oh wow, he could really turn it on when he needs to.
I can't wrap my mind around Adam Sandler being intimidating or scary at all.
Travolta wasn't really intimidating or scary in that movie. It was
there were a few times when he got real serious and it worked.
Go see Punch Drunk Love, man. That's all I'm saying. Go see Punch Drunk Love.
I've seen it.
<That's> amazing. Do better, sirs. Do better.
I think Jeremy agrees with me that Adam Sandler is a really hard choice. Is a really
both,
hard cast on that one.
Both of those are so fucking weird. If you had told me you wanted Eddie Murphy to play Marcellus Wallace, I'd have been like, yeah, okay. Because, you know, he does the serious stuff every now and then. That to me, I can buy a little more than him going as Jules.
Hey, I want to see that.
We know you do.
All right. So who's next? Who wants to go?
I think you get to choose, Brian.
All right. Let's go with Jonathan.
All right. So in thinking about nonlinear storytelling, this was one of those really, you know, first movies that popularized the nonlinear storytelling. I decided, why not go with somebody who's really mastered that? And let's have Christopher Nolan do Pulp Fiction.
Interesting. I actually thought about Christopher Nolan, and I was like, wow, yes, it would be amazing, but I don't know if he'd have fun doing it, but I'm into it.
I think it could be fun. I mean, there are certainly aspects of some of his movies that are fun, not necessarily as in-your-face weird as, you know, Quentin Tarantino style, but I think it could be delivered in a way that was similar. It'd have to have that Christopher Nolan vibe, though. So it's going to be a little bit darker, but more black humor, I'm not sure. Starring as Vincent, I decided to go ahead and cast Ryan Reynolds.
You say Ryan Reynolds and Adam Sandler? Really? You give me shit?
Ryan Reynolds is actually not like Adam Sandler, believe it or not.
Oh, my God.
Believe it or not, Ryan Reynolds and Adam Sandler are kind of different.
I completely agree with that statement.
Oh, my God.
Ryan Reynolds can be scary when he wants to be. He can be funny. He can be scary. He can be serious. He can be kind of offbeat and goofy. I think he would be able to do all those things.
So can Adam Sandler, man.
Okay. And as his partner, Jules, I think Mos Def.
Interesting. So I've seen Mos Def in a lot of things. I've never seen him like... I'm curious to see that.
I forget what show it was, but there was something I saw him, and he was actually a little bit scary and intimidating in that role. And I liked it a lot, so I think that he could pull that off. Okay. And I think that him riffing off of Ryan Reynolds and them, their energy together could be really entertaining. Now, you know what? This is the one I struggle with the most, as Butch, Bruce Willis's role. It's so hard to think of somebody that is the right age to do that role now. Because you just don't have a lot of people that are like that anymore in the actor world. So to have somebody that is scary but also likable and could be believed as an athlete, you know, somebody that's got a little bit of muscle on them. Because there were definitely some times that Butch got scary in that movie too. So it has to be have to have all of that stuff, but he's likable. So I would have cast Dexter himself, Michael C. Hall.
Oh, I love that guy. I'm in for that.
I love Michael C. Hall, and I think that he displayed in the show Dexter that he was able to be scary and super likable all at the same time. And he's got a physique on him. If he worked out a little bit harder and got kind of bulked up, I think he could be a very convincing boxer. As Marcellus Wallace, the big scary himself, there was only one choice for this one for me, and it's Dwayne Johnson.
What?
I would love to see Dwayne Johnson being totally scary and just being a really frightening bad guy.
Okay.
We haven't really seen it yet. I would like to see it. I would love to see that whole dynamic between him and Michael C. Hall in the basement. That would be really weird and just awesome.
Go get it medieval on your ass. Step aside, yeah. Butch. Let's go good. I use Step Aside, Butch, like almost on a daily basis.
Huh? As Mia Wallace, I decided to go ahead and cast Natalie Portman.
All right.
I think she could pull it off.
All right.
And as Lance, the drug dealer, I went ahead and cast Ronald Weasley himself, Rupert Grint.
I like that.
Oh, that's funny.
That's actually one of my favorite ones I've heard so far from all of it.
That is funny.
I'm glad you guys agree, because I like that one too.
Does he get to talk with his British accent?
I think it would work either way. I think it would be great with the British
accent. I agree, but I almost want to hear it with the British accent.
Yeah, I think it'd be fantastic.
I just want to hear him as like grown-up, fucking washed-out drug dealer Ron Weasley.
Exactly. That'd be so much fun. And as the Wolf, I would love to see Robert Downey Jr. playing that character.
He would be a fun character for sure in that.
I think he would bring such a great energy. And, you know, because Robert Downey Jr. is definitely able to be classy while still being kind of a lunatic. And I think that it'd be such a great energy to that whole scene. It'd be a lot of fun.
All right.
That's my casting.
I'm into a couple of those, not all of them.
Which ones stood out to you as being ones that you liked?
I liked the Michael C. Hall, and I liked Rupert Grint the most.
I'm glad you liked those.
I did. I actually thought you were going to say somebody else for Jules or Marcellus, but we'll see if Jeremy picks them. Jeremy, Pulp Fiction recast.
All right. So for director, I went with somebody who recently made a really big movie that did shit that I was totally not expecting to happen and is also good with the nonlinear stuff. I went with Rian Johnson. Between Star Wars and Looper, you know, I thought those were – he'd be an interesting choice to do it. for Vincent and Jules, for Vincent, I went with Colin Farrell.
Okay.
Just because I feel like Vincent just always has this, like, I don't want to say, like, just kind of, like, gritty, like, unwashed quality to him. But I just feel like Colin Farrell just always has a little bit of that vibe. And, you know, Jules to me was tough because I feel like they have to be intimidating in the same way, sort of, like, nobody can really be intimidating and yell at you the same way that Samuel L. Jackson could. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go with somebody who's really fucking big. And I went with Winston Duke, the guy that played M'Batu in The Black Panther.
Oh.
Like somebody who's just like fucking gigantic and intimidating and can probably also yell, but doesn't really fucking have to if he doesn't want to.
All right.
All right. So for Marcellus Wallace, I opted for Will Smith.
Okay.
Interesting.
Because I was like, you know, he can do intense when he wants to do intense. You know, he can do the character stuff. And I thought it would just be fun to watch him just play that fucking guy the whole way through.
It would be great to see that scene with Will Smith and he's walking with donuts and he sees Butch in the car and he just turns and goes, motherfucker.
That's a really good point. I would love to see him in doing that scene.
Be good.
Mia Wallace, to me, that was the hardest. I didn't come up with anybody that I felt like was a great fit. I settled on Anne Hathaway was the last one that I kind of went through where I was like, all right, maybe that one. But that one to me was the hardest because there wasn't anybody where I was like, ooh, that sounds fun. For Lance, I'm going with Oscar Isaac.
Oh, he'd be fun.
All right, I like it.
And for the Wolf, this was my favorite pick of all of mine. I went with Arnold Schwarzenegger just because I was like, I figured he would be the best person to show up at fucking 9 a.m., you know, with a tuxedo and a cigar. Just because I figure with the Wolf, you need somebody who not only looks like they knew how to clean up and solve a dead body problem because they killed a bunch of people already themselves. And I just felt like he would be a good pick for that.
That would be great. I like that.
I like it.
Bonus recasting on the fly here. The part of, I think, Jimmy, who was played by Tarantino himself in the original Pulp Fiction, who had where Jules and Vincent brought the car with the dead body in and the wolf comes over. I want to see Jerry Seinfeld play that role because I want to see him freak out and say the words dead N-word storage.
Really?
What's the deal with all this storage? I don't know. I think that would be hilarious to see Seinfeld in such a role and have Arnold or Patrick Stewart come over to Seinfeld and just say, look, here's what you need. So who on the fly, can y'all think of anybody you'd want to see in that role?
Oh, that's a tough one to think about on the fly.
I just thought of that.
I now that's all I can think about. I think that Ewan McGregor would be funny in that role.
Oh, I agree with that.
I think that he would pull off the kind of being flustered and irritated completely just, but like, how, you like my coffee, you know? I think he could deliver that.
All right. Jeremy, anybody?
Nobody jumping to mind offhand on that one.
All right. Well, that was our recast of Pulp Fiction. If you can do better, let us know. And that pretty much wraps up Mediocrity, this episode of this week in February 2018, where the show is just okay. We've had a lot of laughs, a few cries, but we always love you, and we'll be back next week. Any lasting thoughts, Jeremy or Jonathan?
I watched Marathon Season 2 of The Expanse on Amazon. Have either of you guys watched that?
I have not.
I have not.
It's very good. Very kind of science fiction-y as opposed to the science fantasy stuff we get in things like Star Wars. It's pretty fun.
Cool. Might have to give that very a nice. Shot.
Yep.
Jonathan?
All I've been doing is watching The Great British Baking Show.
Ah.
That show's amazing.
I love that show.
It's so good.
It doesn't even make sense. I still am baffled as to how good, why I like that show so much.
I agree.
I love it.
It's amazing.
Well, that's it for Mediocrity for this week. We'll be back next week with another fun, mediocre show. We love you. And subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. Type in the Multimedia Men and just click that button. We will love you forever. We'll see you next week.